Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast from the Early Morning Late Show. Welcome to the show. It's 4 minutes after the hour, so glad you're with me this morning. And I hope you are already aware that today is a Thursday. You know, sometimes these weeks go by so fast. It's May 17th, and it is the preamble day to the weekend, because today's Thursday, and then tomorrow the weekend starts. And weather has been spectacular. And yesterday I went to a baseball game, which was really fun. And I was waiting outside the stadium, and they've got this big baseball glove that was it's kind of a place where you can meet and you can jump in the glove and get your picture taken, and it's kind of fun. They have some nice statues there at Target Field in Minneapolis. So I'm waiting outside the glove, and this guy walks up with his woman and hands his phone to a person standing by and said, "Would you just hold this up and just, it's a video, would you just film this?" Guy, sure. So he holds the phone, and the guy and his girl get up in front of the glove, and he proposes to her, pops out the ring. So there you go. In other news, the Pope is telling the nuns to tweet less and pray more. So there. And
that's all we need to know today. Someone proposed in front of a giant baseball glove.
Yeah,
and nuns shouldn't tweet as much.
I'm all this important news you need to know. That's why I'm here. But no, seriously, it was a very sweet moment, and it didn't happen very fast because, you know, they're imposing on a complete stranger to video their proposal. And, you know, she said yes, and they were hugging and kissing. And
aww,
then,
see, there's the happy ending to the story.
It's a very happy ending. And unfortunately, if I don't know what team they were supporting, if they were Twins fans, they were disappointed. If they were St. Louis Cardinals fans, like Dick Whitworth, a station general manager, he was very happy. So anyway, all right, Dr. Peter Kapsner is in studio, and he was in France, and he had quite an experience at Normandy. We're going to hear about that, among other things, and be back in just a minute. Welcome back. It's 8 minutes after the hour. Dr. Peter Kapsner is in studio. And do you know that no one has ever seen Peter and Batman in the same room together?
I'm sad that you're bringing this up right now. That you're revealing something.
I'm just saying. I've seen you in a room with Commissioner Gordon, and I've seen Batman in a room with Commissioner Gordon, but I've never seen you and Batman in the same room ever.
Yeah, I've revealed. Secrets revealed. This is one of those History Channel deals, and now you just brought it out. I have secretly wanted to be sort of a nighttime vigilante for the better part of my life, and so the fact that you're bringing this out now is real troublesome.
Yeah. Well, welcome back. I know you were in France for, what, 8, 9, 10 days?
It was actually 16, it turned out to be.
Wow.
Yeah, we were there for quite some time. It was really, in some ways, a trip of a lifetime.
No
yeah,
kidding.
We took all five of our children. My parents went, obviously Hallie and I, and we spent about a week in Paris. And then we went to the north and stayed a few days in a beautiful home on the English Channel, and then hit the French countryside for our last couple of days. And just, I mean, one thing after another. It really was an incredible trip.
Let's talk about Normandy.
Yeah, so our last couple of days, we had a couple trips we wanted to take yet, and one of them was to the beaches in Normandy, and I really didn't know what to expect. And so many of my friends have just even questioned my faith for not having ever seen Band of Brothers and the stories of Normandy. So I didn't really know what to expect when we got up there. And we went to Omaha Beach. There's obviously five beaches mm-hmm. that the Canadians and Brits and Americans took during that incredible invasion. And we went to one of the American beaches, and it was Omaha Beach, where they have the incredible cemetery of, I think it's over 10,000 graves that overlook the channel like that. And it was as sacred and sobering and stunning as anything I've ever seen. It really, we sat there with my kids and just read the stories and watched the videos of people still alive today that experienced it and the sacrifices made on behalf of freedom and good in this world. It really was an incredible experience. Really grateful for that.
Well, I haven't. I have to admit, I've not seen Band of Brothers, so I'm in your camp. But
yeah.
Of course, I've seen Saving Private Ryan.
Yeah, me too.
And I have to say, it was one of the most chilling, painful, gut-wrenching 20 minutes of any movie I've ever seen.
Yeah.
To think that actually happened, and
yeah.
the pains and perils of war, and it's just so hard to swallow. It's so hard to believe.
It is. I think, you know, we would watch these videos where they had the actual footage of the ships in the harbor and just the scope from horizon to horizon of these ships and these people. They had 50,000 tanks, for example, that were just on these carrier ships out in the sea. And so you'd watch these videos and then go stand on those beaches. And it was so, unfortunately and fortunately, both easy to picture that horizon filled with these young 18 to 20 year olds that were willing to give and to sacrifice in the way that they did to take these beaches. You really could almost feel and hear the scenes of the battle. And we talked a lot. I think often about the idea that God's kingdom and the kingdoms of this world are different kinds of kingdoms. They play by a different set of rules. And so it's not always easy to just say this country or this kingdom is consistent with Christianity or whatever it is. They really are different kingdoms. But in that place, the line between the kingdoms felt really thin to me, where you just had this other-centered sacrifice where people were willing to give up their lives on behalf of the future.
Mm-hmm.
And that's so much about what the message of the gospel is Jesus giving up his life so that the future could be opened without fear and with love moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really what I experience is a coming together of the kingdoms of this world with the kingdom of God in a really unique way.
That's pretty profound.
Well,
I
had 16 days of rest, Bill.
Yeah.
I didn't have to really think about anything other than this stuff. So
yeah.
I'm out now. That's all I got. But it was solid.
I think of these soldiers being struck down, in the prime of their life.
Yeah. Oh.
And I mean, even just getting to the beach. And I remember in the movie, just the rough waters and these kids getting just sick and nauseated, just trying to get there only to then end up dying.
That was it. You know, we watched a video. It was about an 18-minute video that you can go into this special theater. And what they did such a profound job of, and I watched with my kids, was some of the stories of the young men prior to Normandy. So they were, you know, some of them were farmers. Some was a scholarship athlete. And they just, everybody had a story.
Mm-hmm.
And then you would watch their stories as they hit the beach. And just what you said, they couldn't get within even 100, 200, 400 yards of the beach, sometimes even further out than that. And they had to jump off of these little boats filled with young men and waterlogged 50 pounds on their back up to their neck in water. So they had to struggle their way through to before they even got to the beach, when then it was just open fire and an incredibly profound story of about 30 young rangers that were tasked to then go up into the cliffs and make their way to take out the artillery battalions that were the ones doing so much damage in that moment. And I just stood there just staggered with what they were capable of at 18 to 20, what they were willing to give their lives for, and they were doing, I'm not going to say with a smile on their face, it wasn't that, but a sense of earnestness and courage and calling that drove them. It didn't mean they didn't have fear, but they knew that what they were doing mattered. And that was the message that I received just over and over again as we watched all of this.
Mm-hmm. Steve Martin said that the French have a different word for every one of our words. Did you find that to be true?
Yeah, clearly. I was completely flummoxed in every single cafe.
Oh, you had to have been.
I was. Hallie knows a bit of Spanish, or French.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
I'm still speaking in tongues from that time. She knows a bit of French, thankfully. Spanish would have not been as helpful. And so I would just sit back and just say, I'm done. I can't even order that baguette. And she would come up and say something about jambon and ham and the sandwich.
Right.
And I would just then eat whatever was brought in front of me. But I learned, I think, oui and maybe si vous plaît I used in context one time appropriately.
Yeah.
But my kids just love having fun with me and mocking me for my entire lack of French in this situation.
Well, I can understand why.
Yeah.
I enjoy it as well. So let's talk about, we've been talking about Old Testament today. And I don't want to segue too far away from your trip if you have more to share.
No, I mean, there's so much. Obviously, but that was a really stunning moment.
Do you have a slideshow or anything you want to try to run?
I'll send you one, and then you can decide.
Okay, good.
Yeah,
good. Have you ever worried, Peter, that God would punish you or strike you down for something you did? Has that been part of the way you have thought at any time in your life?
Yeah, you know, I think early on there's that sense both that, and I think we misunderstand the Old Testament, that God's primary posture towards us is one of anger, that he really can't just sort of wait to wipe us out for making mistakes. But I think so many of us, and I appreciated last hour's guest on some of this Old Testament, because it can help break down the misconceptions that God is just sort of always there to strike us down if we make mistakes. And if we really read through the Old Testament and understand what's there, we can see that if God is going to move and lift his hand against creation in some way, it's always the last move that he does in a redemptive process of wooing people back. And it's only at the very end of a long process when his future is being threatened. And it's out of great grief and disappointment that God will then move in those ways. He's not just waiting as this angry person in the sky to strike us down, like I think we sometimes wonder about. And I did, I think, until I had a better understanding of the Old Testament, I would say I did live in fear of God in those ways. And I can say this, when I bring these topics up to my young people in my classes, I would say at least 9 out of 10 of them live in some kind of fear relative to that. And it's based on such a misunderstanding of the Old Testament.
Yeah, that's a remarkably satisfactory answer you just gave.
You know, that's 2 for 2 this morning. I need to go away like this for a couple weeks regularly.
This rest and jet lag is working for you.
Well, you know, it's middle of the day for me right now. The only thing I'm missing are pastries some way. I've been disoriented by the lack of pastries this morning.
Rebecca, get him a baguette, would you? Thank you, please. All right, now... Are we going to break? I guess we are. We're going to go to break. When we come back, I have more questions about, you know, Old Testament God's anger. And when is it good to be angry? And how does a person find a balance between what would be like appropriate angry, and then we also have to be in loving, steadfast relationships.
Yeah,
so we'll chew on that during the break. Be back in just a minute. Dr. Peter Kapsner, John Bloom has already snuck in too.
Live from the Twin Cities, it's the McArnold Group. For over 3 months, the sharpest minds, the best sources. And now, here's your moderator, Bill McArnold.
Welcome to the McArnold Group. The law firm of Beckley, Schmeckley, and Schmeckley said I can no longer do the vocal impression of John McLaughlin. Not because it's so good, because it's so bad. So I can't do the voice. I can't do the impression anymore. So anyway, welcome to the show.
Sorry to hear that.
Yeah, John Bloom, nice to have you back in the studio. And Peter Kapsner, we've got many things to talk about in the McArnold Group. Issue number one today is anger and God's anger. Anger. How do we deal with it? And his keeping a balance. When is it okay to be angry? And when do we need to have that steadfast love?
I think one of the pictures or a good starting point is to look at Jesus. If Jesus is going to make the claim, and he did, that if you've seen me, you see the Father. And so however we're going to understand that anger, I think a good starting point is to look at when did Jesus get angry. And he really reserved his anger primarily for the religious establishment and the religious leaders who were creating ideas of the kingdom that were not actually consistent with the kingdom. And they were keeping people out from the redemptive hope that was going to be part of God's kingdom. And they were putting these heavy rules down and tying weights on their necks and all of that. And it's in those moments, or for example, the money changers in the temple that were keeping people out by extorting them. Mm-hmm. And it's in those moments when Jesus got angry. He wasn't angry when somebody was just sinning right there. Obviously, sin was not part of the kingdom, but he was so invitational to come to my table and to be transformed and to be made well and made whole. And so his first move towards sinners was not anger. It was invitation. Mm-hmm. The only anger that we see in Jesus is towards those who are keeping people out.
Yeah. John Bloom, author, board chair, co-founder of DesiringGod.org is with us as well. Issue number two, we must disappoint someone. How to say no to good things. John Bloom.
Good morning, John.
Good morning. And my answer is yes.
What does that mean? Because it was a very catchy article that you wrote for Desiring God. And you said,
can I actually just jump back to what you were just talking about?
Sure.
Can I just seize the agenda and change it?
You may. Go right ahead. This is a very loose show.
Great.
The McArnold Group, anyway.
Yeah, I'll be speaking in Spanish in a moment anyway, so we're good.
One of the things about, when you think about the Old Testament, it's really a mistaken understanding to think of the God of the Old Testament versus the God of the New Testament as if they are different people. They are not different people, and it's a misconception to think that the God of the Old Testament is primarily angry. I mean, we do see, but the Old Testament stretches over a long period of time. If we read carefully, what we really see is God bearing with centuries of sin and warning and warning and calling and pursuing over and over, and then you know, reluctantly bringing justice because he is holy, because he is righteous, and he brings judgment upon unrepentant sin that just is persistent. But what we do not see is a God who is got a short temper, and that somehow, you know, God the Father has this short fuse, and Jesus, you know, kind of steps in and diffuses things. That's not at all how it works. And so really, the Old Testament is a story of God's bearing with sin before he ever brings judgment. And that includes not only the people of Israel, but also the nations around Israel that also received moments of justice and judgment.
Yeah, I think that's such an important point to make, because when we see the ultimate redemptive act of God in Jesus, we see it being motivated by love for the world, that he would act redemptively in this way instead of wiping out the world. And so if that's sort of the pinnacle of God's redemptive move in this story of the earth, then we have to understand God dealing with sin through that lens, as opposed to he just mad at me. But I think, unfortunately, I think of me as a father at times. I move as the God of the short temper.
Yeah.
And I think we get confused in our pictures of God primarily because the authority figures in our life often are those people of short temper that we're always concerned that if we make a misstep, there's going to be some big consequence or punishment right away. And we project that on God almost immediately.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. That's absolutely right.
And because we care about how people perceive us, or mm-hmm. how, John, according to you, how we think they'll perceive us. I mean, you like me, don't you?
Yes.
Okay, good. it's going to have a influence on how we're going to choose to use our time.
Yeah.
Right. So, and this article that I'm referring to is one John Bloom has written called "You Must Disappoint Someone: How to Say No to Good Things," and that's tough for a lot of people. So, talk about perception and how we're going to use our time.
Well, you know, it would be. We would all like to think of ourselves as objective people who make decisions about the way we use our time based on all the data presented to us, filtered through some sort of, real objective filter that, you know, where we come down to a conclusion, this is the best use of my time, all things considered. Rarely is that the case. Rarely. I mean, that we do that by God's grace sometimes. Much of the time we are motivated by what other people think of us. And that's not – I'm not saying that that's necessarily a bad thing. There's a good thing. There's good in that, and there can just like anything else, there can be evil to that. But we are people who are significantly influenced by what other people think. And that has a remarkable effect on what we choose to do or what we don't – or choose not to do. And one of the most difficult things to do – and it's more difficult for some temperaments than others, but it's difficult for everybody – is to disappoint people. And it's amazing how much power that can have. And we can stay in unhealthy patterns and even sinful patterns and waste a lot of time and waste a lot of resources because we are so afraid of disappointing somebody.
And with that, because I've experienced that, so much, if I'm honest with myself, of my behavior in my life has been motivated by a worry about what people might think. I experience sometimes the response to that, or the pendulum swing, is sort of this movement that we have in our culture today, which is this me too or me time kind of thing, where I need to have my time or me time. And it's sort of this backlash towards, I'm not going to try to fulfill everybody else's demands. I'm just going to have my time. But that somehow there's some kind of rootedness to that feels maybe selfish to me. Am I misreading that part of it? How do we live a life where we're not trying to swing between not disappointing people or just having my own kind of time? What kind of life are we called to in this?
Well, when you think about it, those responses to, you know, not saying no, you know, like, I don't want to say no to disappoint somebody, and then swinging over to saying, hey, this is, you know, I need me time, that's really coming from a very similar root of selfishness. There are different expressions of it. One is a fear of man, and one is an exasperation, like, you know, you do reach a point, everybody will at different times will reach a point where it's like you feel the oppression of that. You might not even understand you have built this house, you know, by your own behaviors or and it's not due to everybody else. But oftentimes it just subjectively feels like, hey, I'm tired of you controlling me so much, and it explodes into a reaction. And like, I need time for me. And then you know, you might lay into somebody. And so I think both of them come from roots of sort of a selfish orientation.
That's really interesting. This whole idea of who are you going to disappoint? Who are you okay disappointing? That's a huge question, John.
It is. And it's clarifying. I find that to be clarifying. Because and I don't mean like we're wanting to walk around and disappoint people. That should be the aim of our life. That's not the aim of our life. It's just a clarifying question because mm-hmm. it's asking us, why am I giving my time to this? You know, why am I doing what I'm doing? That's just a way of coming at that question with a clarifying effect. Like, am I in this because I'm afraid of disappointing somebody? And if that is, who is that?
And I find, if I'm honest with myself about this, I am comfortable disappointing my kids sometimes over some of the other people in my life. And I think that is a place to really ask some hard questions about that.
That's right.
About those pieces of who do we disappoint and why.
Yeah, all right, we'll take a break, and when we return, the McArnold Group will continue this lively, unscripted, unrehearsed conversation. Be back in a minute. It's 27 minutes until the top of the hour. We're going to take a little break for news. When we return, the McArnold Group will be back in session with John Bloom and Peter Capstern. I just have to say, my imaginary friend thinks you're both a little crazy, but we'll be back for further discussion in just a minute.
Live from the Twin Cities, it's the McArnold Group. For over 3 months, the sharpest minds, the best sources. And now, here's your moderator, Bill McArnold.
You might realize I'm not using the vocal impression anymore. I've been sued. I'm countersuing, by the way. My law firm of Krustica, Bubbas, and Foofenfuss will be helping me fight that lawsuit, so I'm very excited about that. I still have in studio Dr. Peter Capstner and John Bloom, the McArnold Group, and we're just going to try to put some buttons on the disappointing people. So let's say I'm in that position. I've disappointed people, or I feel like I might. How do I prioritize my time and deal with making a better proactive step forward?
Okay, so I think the way we want to use that term, that phrase, who am I willing to disappoint, or flip it around and say who am I unwilling to disappoint? Both those are meant to be clarifying questions to help us get to the root of our motivations. Okay, it's not so much about those other people as it is what is motivating our hearts. That's what we're looking for, and we need to get to the place where we recognize, you know, who we are giving authority to control. Because we need to be giving the ultimate authority to God. God needs to be the one who we are most unwilling to disappoint. And then we need, you know, like I said earlier, it's not that it's bad to be unwilling to disappoint people. That's just the way all relationships work. We just need to make sure that the people who we're unwilling to disappoint are the people for whom it is most loving to do that and is most faithful to our primary callings from God.
And I think if we're careful to listen to God's voice first in all of this and walk that out, almost always are we going to end up being more other-centered in our moves towards people to help and to come alongside and to be present and to serve. That gets to be the outworking of listening to God's voice first, as opposed to just always asking the question, how can I protect my time and how can I make sure I'm doing what I need and want to be doing? But if we listen to God's voice first, it's amazing how much his voice begins to turn us outward towards other people and help. And we're not even asking the questions about disappointment or not anymore. We're entering into people's lives in a way as of where can I help and where can I come alongside and what makes sense and what resources do I have to be with people. And there's a clarity that comes then when you know you can't actually do whatever that thing is, and you can say no in a much more peaceable kind of way just because you're listening to God's voice first.
Yeah, and the story that illustrates that best that I actually used in this article is that famous story about Martha and Mary, and Martha was busy serving, and it's Luke described her as being distracted with much serving, and she thought she was doing the right thing. She was not in touch with what was motivating her, and she was so confident that she went to Jesus and told her, you know, look at Mary, she's not helping me. Would you tell her to get up and help me? And Jesus wouldn't do it. And he said to Martha, you are anxious and troubled about many things. But only one thing is necessary, and Mary has chosen the good portion. Now, if you were sitting in that room, you might have been, just by observing, you might have looked and said, well, Martha looks like she's doing the good thing. She looks like she's serving everybody. Mary looks like she's being inconsiderate. She's just sitting there listening. She's not helping. But they're motivated by two different things. One is motivated by anxiety and trouble. She's probably, according to the context, anxious about what all those guests are going to think of her if she doesn't do that. All right. So she is not listening to Jesus. She is busy. Mary probably knows Martha very well. She probably reads Martha's, all her body language before she even says anything. She knows that Martha's disappointed, and she's willing to disappoint her because Jesus is there, and she's unwilling to disappoint him. She wants to listen to him. And so I find that to be a very helpful illustration.
It's a great illustration.
Yeah, it really is. And again, I think it's a practical step to just even sort of have my life starting the day of, God, what are you calling me to in this day? What do I need to what do I need to attend? And these kinds of questions do then bring a different kind of peacefulness. I know my days are too often ridden by anxiety when I'm worried about all of the people that I either have to impress or disappoint. And so many of my experiences in life are driven by that.
Yeah.
So it's a really helpful starting point.
All right, if we can go to issue number four now, which I think would be our words. John, again, you wrote a great article in desiringgod.org, how to pray about what you say. Now, so our words need to be taken seriously, that we'll be justified or condemned by our words. Is that true?
Well, it's true because that's what Jesus said. He said that we will be judged by every careless word that comes out of our mouth.
Uh-oh.
So we tend to pray about what we say when we really know that something is on the line. You know, so if you know you're going into a job interview, or you know you're going into a very tense relational conflict, you know that you know, and you're so at those moments we're like, God, please give me the right words, please help me. You know, now that's good. We should do that. It's not that that's a bad thing, but those are the times that we tend to be conscious enough of our words to pray about them. But Jesus says that what we will be judged by every careless word that we speak. So that's Matthew 12:36. We will give an account to God for every careless word we speak. So it's what we say when we don't think everything's on the line that really portrays what's in our heart.
Well, and I have to confess, we were in quite a pressure cooker yesterday trying to get to our flight to come home from France. And we thought we left in more than enough time to get to the airport, get through security, all of that. But as one meltdown happened after another, we got lost on the way there. I wasn't exactly the most friendly driver as Hallie was trying to navigate us to the airport. And the pressure cooker just kept building to the point that we made our flight with 2 minutes to spare. They were keeping the gate open as my children are running through the concourse with their bags trying to get there. And all along that 2.5 hour to 3 hour time, I wasn't thinking, gosh, how can I talk to God about this journey to the airport this morning? And so in those places, in the pressure cooker of that, both things that I thought internally and at times came out at just agents trying to help or at people along the way were maybe less than friendly in those moments. So it really is in those pressure cookers of life that I think I found an invitation to another step in the formation journey. Yesterday, yeah. We'll say that I remember sitting on the flight on the way home and reflecting on Jesus's words of blessed are the peacemakers. And I was certainly not one of them for those 3 hours yesterday. And so it's a very sobering thing about who did we affect and impact along the way and just the regular interactions of life. This isn't some big over-spiritualized kingdom thing. This happens day in and day out. And certainly some things in my life were revealed in the midst of a pretty profound pressure cooker.
Yeah, it's the unguarded moments that what we say in the unguarded moments are the things that most clearly reveal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And Peter, those are some real first world problems you have.
Yeah,
racing to catch my flight home from Paris.
Yeah, it was. It was real. But you know, we're trying to build a culture of travel as a family, and so you know, to have some of that time together, learn some of those first world issues is fabulous.
All right, now, John, you gave us some good instruction. 4 points. I'd like to try to cover those in the McArnell Group before we end our time here, regarding how we use our words. So, teach me to tremble. Start with that one, then we'll go to break in about a minute.
Well, if we are going to be held account for every careless word we speak. What Jesus is saying is there's a lot at stake in the words that we say. Because as he says elsewhere, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. And so a lot is at stake. The mouth is a gauge for what's going on in the heart. What comes out of our mouth is what's usually there in our generally more unguarded times, not the times when we're putting our best face forward. We can say a lot of insincere things to impress other people, but it's in the unguarded moments that we show ourselves. So we need to tremble over what we say. Mm-hmm. We need to tremble. Our words ought to make us tremble more than they do, not just at the times when we know that things are a lot is at stake, but when we are not, when we're just home. And so we must learn to tremble over words. Words have great power, and they have power to be a tree of life, it says in the book of Proverbs. And they also have the power of death. The life and death are in the power of the tongue.
Wow. That's Proverbs 18:21. When we return, the second point is guard my mouth from speaking death. You're listening to John Bloom, Peter Kapsner. The McArnell Group is in session. We'll take a short break. It's 13 minutes until the top of the hour. Stay tuned for more. Just a minute. Eleven minutes till the top of the hour. The McArnell Group is back in session. John Bloom from DesiringGod.org and Peter Kapsner, whose rookie card is worth $1.81 American. So nice to have you both in studio. All right, we're going to talk about our words and how careful we need to be with them. And John, you were speaking about using words that speak death. That was a riveting thought. So elaborate on that, please.
Okay. So we said that quoted Proverbs 18:21, death and life are in the power of the tongue, and it really is true. It's obviously literally true for those who either have the authority to pronounce life and death over somebody. It's also true for those who just steal that right. But there's also lots of lesser deaths, so to speak, that happen when we speak things that kill people's hope, kill people's joy, discourage people's faith. That power, it's remarkable. It's remarkable. There are things, Peter, you alluded to just being, when you're young, somebody can say something mean on the playground that just imprints and shapes the way we think of ourselves. So much power can be located in words. Words can be remarkably damaging.
I am super compelled by that Romans 6:23 passage that can be familiar to some about the idea that the wages of sin is death. And that word death there in that passage is there's obviously a literal death of sorts that's part of that. But really what's underpinning that word is the idea of a misery of the soul, that when death is present, there is misery in the soul that is present. And so when you tie that together to what you're saying, which is that our tongue has the power to create life and also it has the power to create a misery of the soul in other people. And that gets to be sobering in terms of what we say and when we say. And I can point to both so many of just even simple statements that have created misery in my own life, or also alternatively be humbled or broken by the misery that I've created in somebody else's life just because of a careless kind of word, or just not, or just exploding a little bit, you know, in anger or whatever it happens to be. There really is things at play day in and day out that are happening with our tongue. And it's a really sobering invitation to think about what we're saying and when we say it and how.
And that's why the psalmist, Psalm 141, verse 3, says, "Set a guard, O Lord, over my mouth, and keep watch over the door of my lips." I think that ought to be a prayer over what we say. That should be just reoccurring in our prayer. Set a guard. You know, because we are, as Paul says in Ephesians chapter 4, we're supposed to put away all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and slander and malice. I mean, a lot of that stuff is represented in words we say. We just don't want that to be pouring out of our mouths. We want to speak what is kind and tender-hearted and forgiving of others.
All right, John, let's talk about the last two points you made in your blog, which you can see at desiringgod.org. Release my mouth to speak life. What a great prayer.
Yeah.
Proverbs 15:4 says, a gentle tongue is a tree of life.
Gentle tongue.
Gentle tongue. I mean, even talk about tone and body language, and, you know, that's important too.
It is, and that's why social media can be so dangerous. We are meant, the way God designed us in most of our communication is meant to be face-to-face, where you can read body language, all the nuance of communication that surrounds speech. The interpersonal, not always, you know, mean things are said on the playground, mean things are said in the workplace, mean things are said in the church, you know, it's not that this completely protects us, but there is meant to be a protection of the interpersonal. There's things you are more guarded in saying when you're face to face with somebody than when you're posting a comment or just saying something where there's the insulation of distance and you don't need to, and your tone is very difficult to read sometimes in an email or correspondence like that.
I would guess impossible.
It's impossible. Mm-hmm. You have to be very good at communication and go over the top to explain, you know, for people to really catch that.
I sometimes say this is a soft tone I'm using. I put it in parentheses. I tell people the tone in some emails.
Yeah.
If I'm expressing something that could be misinterpreted.
Absolutely. And so I just say we want a gentle tongue. A gentle tongue is a tree of life. Gentleness is probably an overlooked fruit of the Spirit in terms of cultivating. But it is a fruit of the Spirit. Jesus calls himself, he's gentle and humble of heart, right? And his primary, the way he communicates, especially to bruised reeds and smoking wicks, is gentleness.
John, one of the things that you make the point of pulling out from the biblical text is the idea that it's out of our heart, it's out of the overflow of our heart that our tongue speaks. So how would you help somebody who, as opposed to living a life of gritted teeth, where we have all sorts of things that we want to say, but we don't because, you know, we guard our mouth just in that way. What's sort of the invitation in terms of a change of heart in this so that our tongue is consistent with how, you know, what's actually going on in our heart? What's the deeper level that we can start walking in with some of this?
Yeah, well, the deeper level is what we would call humility. And what humility is a ruthless honesty before God about who we are and what motivates us and what we're after and what we're afraid of. You know, like it's just humility is not a meek disposition that we just put on. Humility is an accurate assessment of the state of our own hearts before God. Recognizing that in our own eyes, in our own experience, we are the chief of sinners. We're not in anybody else's experience in their body. We really are quick to bring to judge others, and very slow. And we're pretty hard on others when it comes down to it, whether we say it or not. We are often hard on others, and we give ourselves a pretty wide swath. And we need to be ruthless with ourselves. And the more we recognize that before God, and then the more humble you are, the more able you are to receive the grace of God and recognize how we have been treated by God in the face of the way we've treated him. And so I think cultivating humility is the key to being able to treat other people authentically with gentleness.
This is such a fascinating conversation because we are going to go out today and everyone's going to use words.
Yeah.
Everyone. And I think of, you know, even read that children were drawn to Jesus. And I think, well, I know the kinds of people that kids are drawn to. They're fun loving. They're open. They're smiling, you know.
Yeah.
I sometimes think that
they're
we picture
humble.
Jesus. They're humble.
Yeah.
I sometimes think we picture Jesus, this ultra serious guy that, you know, that kids would go, ooh, you know, it's like C. Montgomery Burns. I want nothing to do with this guy. You know?
right.
Simpsons reference, by the way, if you watch it or not. But anyway.
I don't.
Peter smiled. You
I
didn't.
Caught it.
I thought,
yeah,
you know.
I confess I caught it.
I batted 50%. You know, I'm okay with that. But that unfortunately wraps up another riveting episode of the McArnell Group. I won't be using the voice anymore. But thank you so much for being here today. And we'll resume the McArnell Group again in 2 weeks, so you can have that to look forward to. Send any kind of request you'd like for us to discuss. We're unscripted and unrehearsed, and we love it. It's 3 minutes until the top of the hour. We'll be right back. That wraps up the show. Thank you to Peter and John. David T. Lamb, what an amazing guest. And Kim Fook, what a story. What a great show. Thank you for listening. Have a great day, everyone. I'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show. Connecting.